Hey guys, before we get into this episode, we wanted to ask you to help us out with something. We need you to go over to podsurvey.com/biscuits and fill out a quick anonymous survey for us.
We're able to provide ear biscuits to you for free because of our sponsors, but it's important to us that those sponsors be things that you actually care about, and this survey helps make that happen.
At podsurvey.com/biscuits, you'll find a short anonymous survey. It'll take no more than 5 minutes and it's really helpful to us. Your answers will help match our show with advertisers that best fit the sensibilities of our podcast and its listeners. That's you.
When you complete the survey, you'll be entered into an ongoing monthly raffle to win a $100 Amazon gift card. And we promise we will not share your email address. We won't send you an email unless you win. But you got to go to podsurvey.com/biscuits to take the survey.
Listen, I mean, I don't want you to do it for the Amazon gift card. I want you to do it because you like us and we're just really saying pretty please, but hey, the gift card, it might happen. So yeah. podsurvey.com/biscuits to take our survey and a chance to win a $100 Amazon gift card. Thanks. Welcome to Ear Biscuits. I'm Link.
And I'm Rhett. Joining us today at the round table of dim lighting is motivational speaker, best-selling author, and YouTuber, the very inspiring Josh Sundquist.
Okay, Josh's journey began at age 9. Well, I guess it began at age 0.
Yeah.
But you know, the big story began at age 9 when he was diagnosed with a rare form of bone cancer, Ewing's sarcoma, and he was given a 50% chance to live. He spent a year on chemotherapy treatments and his left leg was amputated.
But he didn't let that slow him down. He went on to become a member of the U.S. Paralympic ski team as well as the U.S. amputee soccer team. I mean, this guy's basically excelled at everything he's tried, including writing, speaking, and creating original Halloween costumes that take special advantage of having one leg.
You better believe we talked to him about that. Josh also has a popular YouTube channel where he uploads vlogs and collaborations. His first big video was a rap song called The Amputee Rap.
Yo, let me tell you what it's like to walk a mile in my shoes. I got one leg, but a smile on my face. You've been smiling too if you have my parking space. My leg is cut off way up at the hip, but using these crutches, I run pretty quick.
He's also spoken in person. Believe it or not, in person, that still happens
to
thousands of people all over the nation using his engaging storytelling ability.
How many of you that are like me, and in order to save money, when you go to the movies, you like to smuggle food in your pockets? Anyone do this? So I'm with my friends out front of this movie theater. We're sitting in the parking lot, right? We're putting small candy items in our pockets. My friend pulls out of the trunk of the car a 2 liter of Coca-Cola Classic. This 2 liter, right? And we're like, really, this is not gonna fit in anyone's pockets. I do not understand what you're thinking. But then I think of this brilliant idea. You ready for this? Because my friend is wearing sweatpants, I am wearing shorts. So we switch, I put on his sweatpants. I take the 2 liter, I put it inside of the left pant leg. I tie a knot underneath so it hangs there and looks like my leg is cut off like down here. And then I look down and the 2 liter is just swinging all around. And there's this security guard standing there looking at me, right? And I can tell that he wants to say something. But let's be honest with ourselves. Like, what is he going to say? Like, sir, I noticed that there is a problem with your leg. You are correct, I do not have one.
We cover many topics with Josh, including the moving backstory of him losing his leg, the hilarious experiences from his new book, We Should Hang Out Sometime. That's the name of the book. I would like to hang out with you. That's
you talking
the name
to me?
Of his book. I'm talking to
We're
him.
Hanging out right now.
I'm not looking at you. When I look into space, when we're
You're
talking-
You're looking at the people?
That's when I'm talking to
the Biscuiteers?
The Biscuiteers.
Okay, gotcha.
Because we
hang
should
out
hang out
too
less.
Much. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. We should write a book called We Should Hang Out Less.
Less. Hey, that's a good idea.
Okay, we should talk to Josh about
We should
that.
At least write a book.
He can write the foreword.
Josh has inspired us to write a book, especially when he shares all the hilarious stories. Basically, he tracked down all of the girls that he dated and tried to find out what went wrong. So
yeah, that's great.
Yeah, that was pretty good. We also explore the crazy questions he's been asked over the years about having one leg.
Now, Josh, he's an amazing example of someone who has been making a living at something they're passionate about and also good at. Mm-hmm. But that's not an easy thing to do. It's not easy to figure out how to get started.
That's why the guys at Road Trip Nation have put together a book called Roadmap. No, this is not the Atlas making a big comeback.
I can't say I wasn't a little disappointed that the Atlas is not making a comeback, because very large roadmaps were a very important part of the trunk in my dad's car.
Oh, I remember that.
Or behind the seat.
Or the top of the dashboard.
Yeah.
I remember all that. No, the tagline of this book is The Get It Together Guide for Figuring Out What to Do with Your Life. Don't you want to know what to do with your life? You can order it at theonlybookyouneed.com.
Well, that's bold. Theonlybookyouneed.com.
Yep.
The Road Trip Nation guys traveled the world talking to all kinds of amazing people who have been a success in doing something they love. That includes Marvel's chief creative officer, professional chefs, sports journalists, entrepreneurs, and beyond. Roadmaps fill with self-discovery activities and the wisdom gleaned from all these people, so you can figure out how to start following your passion and pay the bills, y'all.
I really think this is important. I mean, if I could go back and I had this URL, theonlybookyouneed.com, available to me, I would have gone there. I'm not knocking our guidance counselor, but I'm kind of knocking our high school guidance counselor.
I don't even remember who the guidance counselor was.
We have engineering degrees, people. I mean, who knew it was as simple as going to
No roadmap.
Theonlybookyouneed.com. All right, now on to the biscuit. Tell us about your Halloween costumes. Like, we're nowhere near Halloween, but something tells me that you've been thinking about it constantly year-round based on your track record.
Yeah, it's become a big thing.
I love it.
Yeah, thank you. But yeah, it's a weird thing in that, in so many ways. For one thing, like, as a kid, like, I grew up in like a really conservative, religious home.
Okay.
And we didn't celebrate Halloween at all.
Celebrated harvest?
Yeah. We'd have these the pseudo like harvest festivals or whatever.
Harvest festival. I've been to those.
Or we'd celebrate the Reformation weirdly.
Yeah, it's like, Reformation Day.
Yeah, exactly. We'd be like, "Yay, Martin Luther!"
Would you do trunk or treat in like the parking lot of the church?
No, I don't. What is that?
They do that now where they bring all the insulated families into. They'll allow them to go leave the church and go into the parking lot on Halloween night. And then they go around to the trunks of cars that the church members have parked, and then they give out candy out of the trunk of the car.
Huh. Yeah, and then they go around the neighborhood and they nail the 95 theses on the doors of everyone.
If we were at home, I mean, we literally like locked the doors, turned all the lights off so that like no one would come to our door, because my parents like thought if we gave out candy, we were like contributing to the devil or something.
Yeah, you're a part of the problem.
Yeah. So
were you ever tricked because of that?
What do you like?
Well, there was trick or treat.
Right, yeah. Like people were like, "Oh, you guys don't give out candy.
Here's an egg on your door."
No, I think people just, we did get, actually that did happen once. I don't know if it was in relation to Halloween.
Oh, it was.
But now that you bring that up, it very well could have been retribution from the neighborhood.
Yeah, that's what it was.
For us, like,
you've been egged.
Not contributing to the sugar. But yeah, so I never really even wore any Halloween costumes until college. And perhaps appropriately, given the religious background, my first Halloween costume, I dressed as the Holy Ghost. I just literally just wore a sheet over I just put on a sheet. Like that was how, it was like the worst costume ever. It was like so little work.
What made your ghost holy though?
In the sheets?
No, it was.
You didn't even do that.
I guess I was just, I'm not going to defend the costume here. I will say though that me and two of my friends were in on it, and so we were the Holy Trinity.
I had
a friend who at the time had really long hair and wore a robe, so obviously he was Jesus. And then my other friend had like a long white beard a fake beard. And so he was God the Father.
You didn't send this picture to mom and dad.
No, I don't. They are probably listening to this podcast and very upset right now.
But
that
you did
sacrilege.
But you didn't need just one leg for that.
No, that came later. Yeah.
Like
so that
technically
was just,
you needed no legs.
Yeah, exactly. Technically it was a problem that I was walking. I should have just been floating around.
Right.
But I didn't have the technological know-how for that. So yeah, it was only like sort of later that that I had any sort of amputee related one, and it was the first time I did one. It was after college, and that was when I did a partially eaten gingerbread man. And it was really kind of a lazy thing. It wasn't like I was like, man, what would be like a clever amputee costume? It was like the last minute. And I think it was from like Shrek, you know, the guy was like, my gumdrop buttons or whatever. Right. And so I literally just bought a normal gingerbread man costume and just cut the leg off. And I was like, boom, done. This is my costume. But
that drastically increased the quality of that costume.
I mean, did you know, did you have any indication that, okay, I'm sure I'm going to put this online. And did you know?
No, because this was in 2011. And so this was like pre like kind of BuzzFeed, you know, the concept of like viral images was very new. Mm-hmm, in fact, the only place I posted it was the now defunct site Daily Booth. You guys remember Daily Booth?
Yeah.
So like that's the only record I have of the picture is actually Daily Booth. So it's like super grainy. It was on a webcam, of course. So it didn't occur to me that it was going to be a popular thing online. But like I put it on Daily Booth and it was like all of a sudden all these people were texting me, you know, like, I love your costume. It's amazing. But it still wasn't it wasn't a viral thing or anything, but yeah, I went to parties and most like the main reaction actually was not so much like that's an amazing costume. It was like, where did you hide your leg? This is an incredible illusion you've created.
Right.
And I'm like, I have crutches. Like, why do you think I own titanium one piece crutches like that I bought for this costume?
Because right. You're a high roller.
Yeah, this is how I go with my Halloween costumes. So
Did you follow it up next year with?
No, so it still didn't occur to me, like, because again, it wasn't like a viral thing and it wasn't
okay.
You know, yeah, it just never occurred to me like, oh.
But it did eventually.
Right. So that, yeah. So the next year I was Angry Birds with my friend. You know, it was fine. And then the year after that, my girlfriend at the time, now fiance, suggested, hey, like you should be the leg lamp from A Christmas Story.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I was and I had looked online and some amputees had like done that before.
Okay.
But they hadn't done a real good job. No offense if you're one of them listening right now. But I saw them. I was like, I think I can do way better and like really go all out. So I got like shaved my leg, got fishnet stockings, got an actual lampshade and like lit it up from the inside with like a battery pack. So it was like a portable walking lampshade. And yeah. And that one, when I made it, I was like, I bet people online will like this. Cause this was by then 2013. So like at that point, you know, images online were like a thing.
Right.
And so, so basically a friend of a friend posted it on Reddit. And then it like blew up from there. And then people went back and like somehow found my Daily Booth and they're like, oh, there's this, like, look at this thing you did before. Like, and that's when it became like a thing.
So then the bar started to raise. What was after that?
Yeah. So then, exactly. So then it was like clearly, oh, this is a thing.
You got to do
this. Now people like think I do this every year and have expectations. And so, yeah. So then I felt pressure. And I thought, well, like, the costume with the leg lamp was like so popular because it brought back childhood memories for people, you know, like Christmas Story and all like Fragile and all, you know, all those things. And so I was like, there's no way anything will ever be like that. But, you know, I'll try, you know, see what I come up with. And so the next year this one just happened. I just was at like a zoo once and I saw a flamingo and I was like, you know, that looks kind of like me if I'm doing a crutch handstand. And it was just a weird thing. It was just like, I don't know, just because I give, you know, I do like funny speeches about having one leg. A lot of my humor on YouTube is about amputee stuff. Like I'm just always looking at that stuff. And it was funny because I told a lot of people the costume ahead of time. I was like, I think I'm going to be a pink flamingo. And everyone assumes, oh, of course, because flamingos stand on one leg. And I was like, oh, you have no idea. Just wait. This is going to blow your mind.
Right.
So, so I got like a pink spandex suit. And
very flattering.
Oh, yes. It was.
You mean you didn't already have one?
Yeah.
I pulled out my pink spandex suit.
Yes, from the closet where I keep all of my onesie spandex uniforms. And I should say that my assistant Lisa, who is a huge fan of you guys and your show, helps me with these. She's very crafty, and she like helps me build these things because it takes a lot of like conceptual thinking of like how are we going to actually make this. And then we got like an elf shoe, which she painted like a flamingo head on, and then I just do it's. I mean, you'd have to. It's it's weird in, to describe in podcasts. It's you have to see it,
right?
To get it.
So I guess Google Josh Sundquist Halloween costumes.
But you got
and they'll all come up.
The two trucks. Crutches are the legs to the flamingo, and then you lean your head forward and go into a
handstand.
It's like a half handstand, right?
Handstand.
So it's like my head is the flamingo's butt, and then my leg becomes like the neck, and my foot is like the actual head.
And it has
a beak.
It's very convincing.
Very convincing.
It's pretty like, and I can't really, like, I can balance in like an actual handstand on my crutches, but not in that specific position. It's actually like off balance. So it was like...
It's like flamingo in motion.
Yeah. So it was like me and my girlfriend, we just did like a bunch of shots, you know, with just like in burst mode. and just like, and we had like one that was just like, this is uncanny. It looks so flamingo-like. You know, and we did it. We even went to the zoo too, because I just thought it would be amusing to like do it right beside the flamingos. And
it would be, yeah.
Yes. And, but that was weird walking around the zoo in a pink flamingo, or like a pink leotard.
As an upside down flamingo.
Yeah.
And walking on its head. And,
yeah. So then.
But you've done one more since then.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. So then the flamingo was just huge. Yeah. It was, yeah. So it's just like every year it's like more and more pressure, and like people are like, he wins Halloween again. And so, yeah. So then this year I did a foosball player. And it was like particularly sort of meaningful to me. And the reason I thought it was cool is because this year I had the opportunity to make the U.S. amputee soccer team.
Right.
Which was cool because like before I lost my leg when I was a kid, I played soccer and I hadn't really like played it since I became an amputee. And now there's this like amputee soccer sport out there. And like the U.S. team is finally like, good enough that we went to the World Cup this year. So it was like a cool, like personally meaningful thing to me to be like, oh, I'm going to actually dress like as a semi soccer player in a foosball position. And so, yeah, this one was actually really difficult to construct because we really wanted to have the illusion of me floating. And to look like, cause it's easy to like do Photoshop things, but I wanted to be like, what you see is the actual photo taken.
Right.
So we like rented out an entire like indoor soccer arena because that has that look of a foosball, you know, thing. It has the corners and like
the walls
that sort of drop back. And then we got like a ballet bar and built around that like reflective material to look like the spinning bar or whatever.
Right.
And then and did me up all in like all this like paint to make me look shiny and plastic and just like
it's great.
Yeah.
It's great. The bar keeps getting raised.
Yeah, exactly. So now it's like
and you got the thing on your foot that looks like the big paddle.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. And then so we had just like the big box and I just sort of like sat and balanced there on that bar.
Well, it's funny when I saw that I thought, oh, well, you know, this has been so popular now, there's some sponsor that's paying for Josh to do his Halloween photo. Or did you just say, I know, because it was so like over
produced.
The top and produced. Are you just like, no, I've taken it upon myself that I'm just going to make this happen every single year.
Yeah, I did. I sort of tried and failed, semi-failed at doing like a Indiegogo.
Okay.
So I put it up and it was like, as people do when you do Indiegogos and such, a lot of people were like, what? Like, why would we give you money? Like, people on the internet just want my money.
Well,
like,
because it's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. So a lot of people did give money towards it, but I honestly put it up thinking like, people will think this is cool and fun. Like, I'm happy to pay for it myself.
Right.
So I got some money, but I paid for most of it myself. It was pretty expensive. I'm not going to lie. It was pretty expensive. But because I hired like a real photographer. We had like all the lights up and everything.
Right.
But to me, it's a great investment because people love it. And it's like, it honestly is a part of like the business of what I do, you know, like
right.
I make my living mostly as a motivational speaker. And a lot of people, you know, like when they contact me to speak, they're like, we love your Halloween costumes. You know, like the costumes sort of capture the message of what I'm going to share on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, it's really kind of the best possible advertising I could do is to like invest in a really great costume.
And we should say that those are at the top of your YouTube channel even now. So if you go there to enjoy your content, you can see them. That's the easiest way, just to see them all in collage form.
Yeah, they're all right
at
there.
Once.
Yep.
Take us back. Let's go. We'd love to get your story from the beginning, which I'm sure you've told many times, but I'd like to piece it all together.
So, as a child kind of overview.
Yeah.
So I, like I said, I was when I had two legs as a kid, I was real into soccer. And when I was 9 is when I started having a lot of pain. And it was sort of poignant in that the same week that I was going to try out for my first travel soccer team was the week that I had a biopsy where they found cancer. Cause I'd been having like a lot of pain and whatnot. And so they were like, had to open me up. And it was a really aggressive form of cancer. I had a 50% chance to live.
Whoa.
So it was very serious.
I mean, a 9-year-old, you remember getting that news. Just, is the doctor talking to you? Is the doctor talking to your parent?
Yeah. So my parents told me, there's an interesting thing in kids around that age. Parents sort of make the call as to how much information they want to share with a child. I was old enough that my parents chose to tell me everything, and I'm glad they did. But it's a weird thing because, like, you know, they told me, like, my parents told me that, you know, it was almost like a Santa Claus thing, you know, like, yeah. Oh, but like, don't tell the other kids, because like, they were like, you know, not other kids at the hospital might not know how sick they are. So like, don't tell them, that they have cancer, because they might not actually know.
And they told you like your chances of survival. They went there too, huh?
Yeah. And in that moment, that was like good news to me, because like, as a 9-year-old, the only thing I knew about cancer was my grandfather had died of it. Mm-hmm. And so to me, you know, I wasn't even cognizant that there could be ways to treat it or survival. So like, I immediately thought, I have cancer, I'm going to die. So actually it was in retrospect and sort of ironically, like good news that they were like, no, actually the doctors have told us your kind of cancer has a 50% chance of survival. Which of course is still very low. So I started chemotherapy treatments. I had a tumor in my leg, in my femur, which is like the bone from your knee to your hip. And after about 3 months, the tumor was still the same size. So something had to be sort of done surgically. And there's like a lot of different operations besides amputation that are possible. Like, you can take out the bone and put in a metal rod or a cadaver bone, like all kinds of wild stuff. But the amputation is just like by far the best chance of survival. And it's also, if you try to do what's called a limb salvage operation, your leg is very fragile. And so to me, it was like, as a athletically oriented child, I was like, well, yeah, okay, so having one leg, it's going to be harder to do stuff, but I'm not going to be fragile per se. You know, I can do like whatever I'm able to do physically, whatever I can figure out how to do with one leg, like the doctors aren't going to be like, no, you could break, you know, if you do that sport.
Right.
So you
helped make that.
Yeah. It was me and my parents. We met with like a lot of doctors, got a lot of opinions, met with like amputees. Yeah. And I mean, obviously, yeah, it was a huge decision. But I felt very much like it was a joint decision between my parents and I. And I'm really grateful that, you know, that they involved me with that, right? Because I could see a child who wasn't involved looking back later and being like, my parents chose this for me, you know, this life, whatever. Right. Whereas I look back and say, like, this is the life I chose.
Yeah.
So I lost my leg. I mean, obviously, that's a pretty like traumatic thing. And
yeah, so
I
you,
mean,
yeah. What do you remember about that? About the you know, before the procedure?
Yeah, I guess probably the most sort of notable memories about that were, yeah, right before, you know, I mean, I was really sad, like, especially, you know, in the weeks leading up to it, really sad, like, I cried myself to sleep, level sad. I remember, you know, sitting in the operating, or not the operating room, sort of the waiting room, you know, where you get prepped or wait or whatever before you go back for the operation. And I guess the best way I can describe it is, you guys are old enough, and probably most of your listeners are old enough that, you know, you've had someone that you know die suddenly at some point, and there's sort of this like almost eerie feeling of disbelief, like where you're like, no, like I just talked to him or her last week or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's how it felt. Like, it was this idea, like, I'm going to be put to sleep and then I'm going to wake up and this leg is, you know, like, it's not going to be there. And yeah, it was such a strange feeling. And the doctor and nurse came in, and I hadn't walked for 3 months because, you know, my leg was very fragile. I had a brace on it. I wasn't supposed to put any weight on it. But the doctor and a nurse came in and they had a wheelchair like to bring me back to the operating room. And looking back, I'm not sure exactly why I made this decision. But I guess I realized, well, like, what's the worst thing that could happen? Like, I could break my leg from walking. And so I was like, you know, actually, like, I don't want to use a wheelchair. Like, I don't want to walk because this is like, this is my last chance to walk. And so, yeah, so I walked back to the operating room. And the next memory I had was waking up and just having horrible phantom limb pain. And,
oh, really?
Yeah. And in phantom limb pain, it's just, you know, and of course they had told me about it ahead of time and warned me, but I mean, it's such a strange thing. Like you can't even imagine, like you can't be prepared for it. Like I woke up and I at first I thought like, oh, they didn't even amputate my leg because I could feel it. And it was just like throbbing in pain. And it was in this like really weird position. Like it was like sticking straight in the air. And then like I opened my eyes and it's like, it's not there.
Oh man.
Yeah. And it's so phantom limb pain. It's so wild. And I still think it's like, it's really fascinating just like neurologically. But for a while it was like pretty debilitating pain wise. But I guess, you know, you sort of, your brain is hardwired to have what's called proprioception, which is like the sense of your body in space. Yeah. So, you know, you could lose any part of your body, a finger, a nose, an ear, whatever, and you'll still feel it like in your brain. And you can have pain in it. And that's what the phantom limb pain is. So, so I went through that for a while, but, you know, I felt like, I went through a lot of the grieving beforehand and afterwards, I was, you know, I don't want to like take credit for it myself. I think I had like tremendously supportive parents and friends and family, you know, who had raised me well and had really like rallied behind me. But I really bounced back, I think, a lot quicker than people were expecting, and maybe that you know, than some people perhaps ever do, you know, with an amputation. So yeah, I mean, after like 2 or 3 days after the amputation, I was like running on my crutches, like around the hospital, or like literally like running.
Was it an expression of your support structure alone? Was it also the type of person that you were? Was it an active decision that you remember making that I'm going to run around on these crutches? I'm you know, what were the components of recovery for you for it to be accelerated like that?
Yeah, I think that's an insightful question. And, you know, I think it's a little bit of all of that, right? It's having parent, you know, like great support structure. It's having like taken gymnastics as a child. So I was like pretty agile and had really good balance really quickly. Mm-hmm. And I think there was a decision element too. I think, you know, at that point, I still had another 9 months of chemotherapy in front of me. You know, my life was still on the line. So I think there was also an element of it, of to me thinking like, I don't know how much longer my life is going to be. So like, yes, I have one leg, but I'm going to try and make the best of it, whatever that means.
So there was still cancer in your body at that time. It just...
Yeah. I mean, the weird thing about, you know, having an amputation is you don't, it, like, yes, that got rid of what's known to be the cancer, but, you know, maybe there's like a really small amount of cancer, like in your lungs or, you know, it's metastasized somewhere else. So you still go through the whole, like, the original protocol of chemotherapy, which was a year. So I was on it for another 9 months. So like a year in total. So yeah, it was a lot of chemotherapy, about 100 nights I spent in the hospital.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And it was 3 years before you were declared free and clear of cancer, right?
That's right. Yeah. So 3 years, because most cancer you are declared cured after 5 years, but it just depends on the type of cancer. Mine is very aggressive. And so if it hasn't come back in 3 years, that's when they say you're cured, which is like just the best feeling ever. You know, that's something that I look back on and think of, you know, those times when you're in remission in that period in between, and, you know, you go in for tests every 3 months or every 6 months, and it's just like, has the cancer come back, right? You know? And because if the cancer comes back, it's, your chances of survival are very low. So, you know, those were scary years.
Was your sense of humor that we see now in all of your work something that was present then, even from that young of an age, or something that developed later?
Yeah, that's a great question. Some of both. You know, it took many years, I think, to become as comfortable with being an amputee as I am now. You know, like I wore a prosthesis until halfway through college. When I started high school, I was homeschooled until high school. And so when I started high school, I was very worried, you know, just if that people would even find out I was an amputee. So I think there was a much greater sense of self-consciousness there. But at the same time, really early on, I think humor was actually a way of sort of dealing with it. Right after I got fitted with a prosthesis, this was kind of maybe the first window into like what humor could do and how it could help me cope. I was in the hospital for chemotherapy treatment, and I was treated at a teaching hospital. So a mm-hmm. medical student was examining me and just doing like a physical and taking my vitals and such. And he was like taking my pulse, and finally my mom was like, Joshua, my parents called me Joshua, of course, my given name. but she's like, Joshua like has a prosthesis now, and you are trying to take a pulse from it.
And you found this funny.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so it was like, and I mean, which I thought was just hilarious.
He's dead.
Yeah. I mean, that was probably, just a month or 6 weeks after my amputation. And I think that looking back, that was the first like really funny thing that happened. And I was like, that's really funny. And I think after that, I started looking more and more for like, okay, yeah, like obviously, you know, I'm not, like sometimes people will come up to me after a speech or write in the comments of a video, they're like, man, like your jokes about being an amputee are so funny. Like it makes me kind of want to be an amputee. but they'll always preface it with something like, you know, like, don't take this the wrong way. Right. Right. Where do you know, like, okay. Or like, no What's offense.
Coming? Yeah, right.
No offense here. But, and I'm like, okay, wow. Yeah, that is, you totally got the wrong message. Like, I do not like suggest being an amputee.
Well, that's your perspective is so compelling that that's the effect that it has on.
Yeah, I guess.
Some people. It's interesting because you were 9 when the surgery happened. Link, you've got a 9-year-old son. I've got a 10-year-old son. So we've got like kids in that age range.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm thinking about like that happening and then making that adjustment. Just what about socially
mm-hmm.
In those formative years as you're becoming a teenager and moving into high school? Like how did the fact that you were an amputee at that point play into, you know, how you interacted with other kids?
Yeah, no, it was really, really terrifying at first. You know, it's you know, it's weird now like 20 years later because it's like obviously it's just a part of me, it's not a big deal anymore, but yeah, and in that sense I think, you know, my parents played a really great role in, you know, a lot of times you hear people with disabilities, you know, who have psychologically adjusted well, will talk about how like, you know, my parents never treated me any differently, you know, they, and you know, like that's the key mm-hmm. thing. And I don't think they quite mean that literally, because I think you do have to treat someone according to their his or her own needs. Like, of course you treat each of your kids a little differently, not that you're like showing favoritism to them, but like each of your kids,
they're an individual.
Yeah, they have their own personality, their mm-hmm. own problems, their own hopes, etc. So you know, I think that my parents you know, there were times, you know, really early on, yeah, where I was pretty nervous to like for example, like to go to like the swimming pool, you know, and they found like a friend of ours but I wanted to like swim. I wanted to try it, you know? And so they found like a friend of ours who like had a pool at their house. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have to go to like a public pool. And, you know, I'd gone to like summer camp before I lost my leg, but I was really scared to go back. And so they like basically like bribed me. And I was, in retrospect, very easily bribed considering like how scared I was of summer camp. But they were like, if you go to summer camp, we will give you $25 that you can spend at the snack shop at camp.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, $25 of ice cream? That is amazing. So it was like, that was like so game changing.
It's like, so you back, went.
Yeah, yeah. And
did it work out?
Yeah, and it was awesome. But it, you know, it was like, it was like stuff like that. Like otherwise, without that ice cream, like there was it seems so silly.
It wasn't worth it.
It seems so silly, but like that really was like a deciding factor of me going. And I'm so glad I did, you know, because then it was like that was when I started to get exposure to other people. Because of course I was in a unique situation being homeschooled. Like I wasn't immediately thrust into an environment with like hundreds of kids at once. I had like a social network, but my social network was like my church and my homeschool group, which mm-hmm. was like a pretty small group and a very close knit group. Yeah. And so in that sense, I was lucky to have friends who were, I think, very mature and came from like homes where parents were like giving them like sort of like, you know, don't, you know, like, Josh is still like a normal person, like treat him as such yeah. kind of thing.
I'm sure there are many milestones, but how do you get to become a motivational speaker?
Yeah, so I started giving, the first time I was like giving talks was right around that time when I was like 9-10 years old.
Really?
Yeah, doing, at that time, not like what I do now, but they were like fundraising speeches for my hospital. So, you know, I was like sort of like the poster child to be like for the donors to be like, look, the hospital is helping me survive. You should give money. Here's a funny story about a resident that, you know, who thought I had, or, you know, who tried to take a pulse from my leg, which in retrospect is like the worst possible story to tell. Like, yes, your hospital is like a malpractice suit waiting to happen. Give it money.
Right.
Yeah, so that was the first time I was sort of in front of audiences and, you know, started to grow comfortable with that. And then when I was 15 years old and by that time in a public school, a motivational speaker came to my high school and I just like saw, you know, his speech and just thought like, this is the coolest thing ever. And ironically, you know, I was really interested in doing it, but I was really afraid because I was like, oh, you know, I think to be a motivational speaker, you have to have like a really interesting life story. And I don't have one. Which is
okay.
Yeah, I know. It's like looking back, it's like what? But like at the time, it just didn't occur to me that my life was that interesting. And so my early speeches were terrible because number one, they were like super like didactic and just it was like I listened to other motivational speakers and tried to be like Tony Robbins, you know. So I'd get up and be like, "You must have goals and like blah blah blah. I'm so awesome and you should be like me." And they were just so bad and nobody paid attention. And then gradually over time, I realized the times that people were paying attention was in, you know, the short moments when I might have an anecdote about myself or what had happened to my leg or cancer or whatever. And then gradually then I realized, oh, wait, I actually do have a story. And it's a story that people are really interested in and that people naturally naturally create a metaphor, right? Like most audiences are not composed of amputees, but everybody has that thing for them, you know, whether it's something physically obvious or something, you know, from their background or their emotional state or a developmental disability. Everybody has, you know, that thing that they're sort of insecure about that they're dealing with. And so to hear a story, hopefully from someone who's been through something like that and has come out relatively well on the other side was a story that seems to help people. And that's why I have the privilege of having that job.
Right, what? and you've done quite a bit of it. And, you know, I think my suspicion is that when you do motivational speaking, that you probably get called into lots of different environments where you mm-hmm. find yourself, I'm speaking to like, this convention for whatever, like,
does it get weird?
Yes. What are some of the weird places that you found yourself speaking?
I would say maybe interesting would be the positive spin I would put on it. But you're right. It's really interesting that because I you know, some types of speakers might be an expert on something like leadership or teamwork or whatever. But because I'm just sort of like a life story speaker, you know, I talk about my life story and I apply sort of lessons about overcoming adversity and try to relate to that to what individuals in that particular audience might be going through. Because that's a pretty universal message, I have the privilege of speaking to a really wide range of groups. So yeah, I mean, like I spoke to a group of cowboys like 2 months ago, like literally cowboys, like they are literally cowboys.
Like in Wyoming or something?
North Dakota. Yeah, I mean, I was the only person. I felt uncomfortable because I wasn't wearing a cowboy hat and did not have cowboy boots. Like that was the first time in my life when I've been like, wow, I feel weird because I'm the only one without the cowboy hat.
Did you address that?
I like to acknowledge like those sorts of things. And they were good. They had a good sense of humor about it. But you know, like one of the weirdest ones, and I didn't actually end up speaking to them, but I was really hoping I would because I thought this would be just hilarious. It was like a convention of the, what would you call it? Like the Tanning Booth Industry Association. And I was just like, okay, like I'll definitely speak to you guys and like, that's cool. But like, I mean, you guys kind of have a thing that causes the disease yeah. that I had. Like, it just doesn't seem like,
yeah.
It just seems like if
kinda.
Within moderation, I'm not judging people who go to tanning beds. That's fine. I just like, if I was planning that convention, I wouldn't be like, let's get that guy. Like if I was like a,
yeah, right.
if we were like a smoking convention or whatever, or like, you know, we were Philip Morris, like we wouldn't be like, let's find a guy who's overcome lung cancer.
Yeah. Right.
Right. You know, it's like, it just seems like I'm not the person that you want. So yeah, but it's really interesting to just sort of like the wide variety of groups I get to speak to.
At what point did YouTube start to enter equation? And I'm curious, how does that fit into the puzzle of what you're doing? How do you view your YouTube presence?
My first real like YouTube video was when I was actually here in LA at USC. I was in grad school, and I had no idea what a vlog was, and I was in grad school, and you know, it's very different being in grad school. You don't necessarily like make friends or have a social experience, or maybe actually that's
grad
probably
school
just
for
me.
What
for communications.
Okay, makes sense.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. Nobody has ever like for a speech ever been like, but do you have a degree in communications? Like, I'm pretty sure that was a waste of money. But whatever, it was fine. So, I had this like really wild experience, which is actually, it's in, this is not a plug, but I'm going to go ahead and make it a plug. It's in my new book. We should hang out sometime. But
give it to us.
Because the book is about, I had never had a girlfriend when I was like 25 years old, and I tried to date girls a lot. And I'd had these sort of like one or two date relationships, and people were always like, Josh, I mean, you're not like too creepy, and we assume you're not like a serial killer or anything. Like, why have you never had a girlfriend? And I was like, I really don't know. I have theories, but I don't know. So I went back and like investigated, by which I mean I found like all the girls going like starting in middle school that I had tried to date, and I would like have coffee with them or email them.
You physically found them,
yeah,
and had a physical face-to-face conversation.
Well, I mean, face-to-face.
Yeah. You had an auditory conversation, not a physical yeah. conversation.
Yeah, it was mostly a conversation of words.
Yeah, okay, good. Mostly. Yeah. Maybe a hug or something involved.
A polite handshake.
Didn't get too physical.
Yeah.
This is quite a quest.
Yeah, it was.
And a great idea for a book.
Yeah, and I will, I'm proud to say that I didn't do it like for a book. And maybe that's just even more weird that I was just like, here's a personal development project I'd like to do. It was only like later that I was kind of like, this could be a book. This is kind of funny now. Now that I have a girlfriend and there's a happy ending once I determined that. So I had this experience where there was this girl that I was trying to date, and she was actually a contestant in Miss America. And
you're on the right track so far.
Yeah. So I want to be clear.
Oh,
like
she was Miss North Dakota, right?
Yeah. Don't you know that?
Well, why did we do research for this?
Yeah, Josh? That's impressive. Yeah, that's the one.
Well, and you just spoke to some cowboys in North Dakota. You make it to North Dakota quite a bit.
I do.
And I didn't think there were any humans there.
Yeah.
You've been there at least twice.
No, it's I've spoken in North Dakota a weirdly large amount. I actually like calculated it once, like. North Dakota's population is shockingly small, 600,000 people in the whole state. And there was a time when I had spoken there so often that I had spoken to like a multiple percentage points of the entire state. It was like 3-4% of the state population I had spoken to. So that's how I met Miss North Dakota. We were sort of talking, and this is what, while I was at USC, and so she was going to be at Miss North Dakota, or she was going to be at Miss America, which was in Vegas. And so I got like a ticket through some finagling to like this like black tie gala where I knew she was going to be, and I was going to like surprise her and stuff. And
you had not dated at this point, or had you?
She and I.
What was your status?
We were. I would say we were talking. We would talk on the phone. Okay. But yeah, I mean, we there had been no like physical conversations to use your term. Okay. I'll put it that way.
But you're gonna surprise her.
I was gonna surprise her, and you know, I'd seen so many like rom-coms or I'd seen, I will say, enough rom-coms to know that a grand romantic gesture like this is always is gonna go well.
This couldn't fail.
Like, there's no way it could fail. And of course it failed horribly. Like, I mean, it failed like so horribly, it was just like anticlimactically weird. Like, I was like, you know, she was like kind of like walking by me, and I was like, like, I guess, I didn't really have anything.
You just opened your mouth,
and
your eyes got big, and you shook.
Yeah, really, yeah, that's pretty much what happened. I guess I just imagined she was going to be like, oh, like, you're here, we're in love, let's date, like, I'm your girlfriend now. I don't really know what I thought. that didn't happen. What really happened was she was like, you didn't tell me you were going to be here. And I was like,
it's a surprise.
It's a surprise. Yeah, that's exactly what I was like. That's kind of, that was like the sort of the point. And then she was like, I have to go. Like, cause she did have to like go walk in this procession or something. And that was the whole conversation. And we didn't talk.
Was this before the ceremony, the pageant? Or was
this was the night before.
Night before.
Yeah. And so then
there was no follow up conversation
nothing.
In Vegas.
No, nothing. Not for, like, for months. Yeah, that was just the end. Because I was like, well, maybe she'll text, maybe she'll call. Nope, nothing. So that was one of the ones for the book. When years later, I wanted to be like, so like, remember that time when I showed up to your pageant? So that was really interesting. But this is, we're on like so many levels deep of stories here.
Let's finish that one though. So on your quest in the book, walk us through going, seeking her out.
Yeah.
Because you met up with her again.
Yeah, and we actually had like a face-to-face conversation.
How did that happen?
Giving a speech in North Dakota, obviously.
When you were passing through.
Yeah, of course, my stomping grounds where I often show up to give speeches.
And you put the tux back on.
I was speaking at a bank, to some employees at a bank, and it was like the town she was in.
Like in the vault? I immediately pictured you standing in the vault. No. Gather around, employees, it's safe here.
I picture him behind the teller window.
Yeah, to be clear, when I say, to a bank, I mean, it was like a gathering of employees of the bank. It wasn't to
like
attention bank customers.
Yeah.
I have given some weird speeches like that, and I've learned to be like, I ask a lot of questions now before I agree to show up to make sure I'm not going to be in that. Like, one time I spoke to what I thought was going to be a group of army vets who had lost legs or arms. Okay. And I was like, this is great. Like, I'd love to like support these guys. And it turns out I was actually just speaking at a cafeteria in a hotel near an army hospital.
To who?
To anyone who happened to be in the cafeteria. I kid you not.
Oh,
no
gosh.
Advertising. It was just people who were just happened to be
with
getting
trays.
Their food. And I was just, they were just, yeah, just go, just like stand in the middle of the room and start talking now. I was like, are you serious? Anyway, that's a whole nother story.
Oh, my.
Well, what happened there?
It was horrible. Like, it was so bad.
Did
like,
you get paid?
No, I was volunteering. Like, I thought I was helping army vets.
Was this in North Dakota?
No, this is in D.C.
Okay. So you didn't have to travel too far.
Oh, yeah. That speech was so bad. It was, they had like, there was a TV on. They wouldn't turn the TV off.
Oh.
It was like, oh my gosh. That was probably the worst speech ever. It fortunately has never gotten better, worse than that. So now I'm very careful to ask questions. Like, so this is an event like that people are going to on purpose, right?
This is not a cafeteria.
Yeah. Like, they know I'm going to be there.
Okay, so Miss North Dakota, you triangulated where she was going to be, and it intersected with you giving a talk.
Yeah, I'd like to like make it sound less creepy than that. Like, I wasn't like triangulating her cell phone. Like, okay, I see her coordinates. This is where she is. I will show up there. I contacted her and invited her to come to my speech.
Okay,
and we're like, yeah, let's like, you know, get food afterwards, And so I and by this time, I was sort of more, it was an interesting conversation, because we talked and she was kind of like,
I'm loving this, by the way,
because she was, Yeah, she was like obviously remembered the situation, you know, the me showing up and was really impressed that I was there because the gala that I was attending was supposed to be $2,000 a plate. I had gotten a ticket because I gave a free speech at a
cafeteria somewhere.
Yeah, at a cafeteria. it was weird, but totally worth it. And so first she was just so which to me made it even crazier. Like she was like. She thought I had spent $2,000 to see her. And I was like, so why you didn't text me? Like, what happened, right? And so, because at the time I thought, well, maybe she has a boyfriend that just entered the picture or something like that. But so it was basically like a really interesting lesson for me in sort of empathy and like looking at something from another person's perspective. Because for her, it's like the biggest moment of her life, right? You know, she's been preparing this literally for this moment for years. And she's very focused on the competition. And this guy like just shows up and she's very like befuddled and confused and just like literally doesn't know what to say. And then the competition happens and she didn't like do as well as she wanted. And then so she was like a little like embarrassed, you know, like that maybe felt like mm-hmm. she had kind of like let, because, you know, she had other friends and family there and she felt right. like she had kind of like let everyone down a little bit. And so it was, you know, that's where she was coming from. And I was coming from just sort of a place of insecurity where I was like, oh, if she didn't like text me immediately afterwards, she must not like me. I'm never going to talk to her again.
Yeah.
You know? And she was like, yeah, but I was like really disappointed. You know, you didn't contact me afterwards because like I was so into you. And I'm just like, what? Like, wait, hold on. Like, you really liked, you know? So, so then I was like, well.
So it becomes crystal clear that you really did blow it.
Yeah, that it was crystal clear. Speaking of crystal, it was soon, I was beginning to get thoughts in this conversation like, well, maybe now that we've figured this
better
out.
Better late than never.
Yeah. But it just so happens that approximately 6 weeks before this particular dinner, she got engaged and had a diamond ring. So that's what the book is about.
Each chapter is
a different girl.
A different girl.
Yeah. So it's there's like six. I actually tracked down 12 girls, and six of them are in the book. Some of them were like just not interesting enough for the book, or there wasn't like a. It wasn't, I don't know, just not, you can't fit every, there was like more stories and, you know, your editor always wants to cut stuff out. So there's
a sequel.
Yeah.
You got a sequel. The
B-side girls is what you should call that one.
Now, just to go back for a second, we took the detour from you getting into YouTube.
Right.
So you were at USC.
Yes. So yeah, so I had this experience, I'll give you sort of the abbreviated version of the story. While I was in, I was getting ready, or you know, I was at the black tie gala, and I don't like you guys have you ever worn a real bow tie before?
Not a real bow tie. I'm afraid of that.
Yeah, you know, I have one that ties around. Yeah,
yeah, like and you have to tie it.
I didn't tie it.
Okay, yeah. So this I feel like that would be a good.
That's him. What do you
mean?
A to
good
say
GMM
was no.
episode of just trying to do this like as a challenge because it's freaking impossible.
Okay,
like, they're always crooked and like uneven and lopsided. So I was in the men's room. You know, trying to like get all spiffy before my like big grand gesture when she saw me. Uh-huh. And I was, you know, I'm like worried about my bow tie, but it's like, it's so hard to tie, right? I'm just like, oh, like I can't get it. I was really frustrated.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, you know, the next time I wear a bow tie, I'm going to do like a clip on, you know, like what you wear to prom where it's like pre-tied. Because I was like, a real bow tie is just not worth it. Like that was the phrase in my mind. I was like, this is not worth it. And this guy walked in and just part of like having one leg is that people, strangers, for some reason feel a certain subset of the population feels just just like they have the right to like say anything they want to you to inquire about your medical history or they feel even just a need to say something about how you have a disability.
Okay.
So this guy, he walks in and he's like, because I was like kind of balancing at the mirror, like working my bow tie. He's like, oh, it looks like you do pretty well with that. But but I was so focused on my bow tie.
With those two hands you have.
Yeah. But I was so focused on my bow tie. And like, I don't, you know, I talk a lot about having one leg in my speeches and videos and stuff, but I don't like necessarily actively think all the time, like I'm an amputee. This is my perspective. So like, I wasn't really thinking, like I thought he meant my bow tie. So I was like, oh, thank you. Like, you know, I appreciate that. And this is like the totally true story. So we go over like to the urinals. I guess I gave up sort of or came to a satisfactory point in my bow tying, and we're both standing at the urinals, kind of nearby each other, and I was like, I I'm still thinking about my bow tie, and he's like still thinking presumably about my life situation, and I was like, I'll tell you though, it's actually pretty difficult. Like, it's pretty difficult.
You start opening up to the guy about the bow tie.
Oh, my goodness.
While we are peeing. And the dude is like, yeah, like, it looks like it would be pretty difficult. And then I said, I kid you not, I was like, in fact, tonight I've been feeling like it's just not even worth it.
And his pee stream stopped.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he's like, you know, making eye contact, like, number one rule of social interaction in urinals.
Yeah, yeah.
No eye contact.
He's
looking at me. He's like, son, it's always worth it. And I was still thinking about my bow tie.
This guy's really into bow ties.
Yeah, I was like, I didn't think I was that good at tying it, but maybe I'm better than I thought. Like, and so it literally didn't hit me till like weeks later. I'm sitting in my dorm room at USC, and I was like, oh, like, that's why he was so like dramatic and like worried for me. He thought like I was talking about my life not being worth it. And so I'm sitting in my like one room, my single at USC. And I was just like, I have to tell someone about this story. And I had a webcam, and I was like, maybe I could just like record this into the webcam and put it on the internet. And I did. And that was my first vlog.
And were you hoping that that guy would see it and be at ease?
I did.
Dude at the urinal. This is
I
for
did
you.
Assume that, yeah, he's like probably out there, like, you know, having prayer vigils for, you know, like, I met this depressed one-legged man.
It was destiny. He's
he was
open right up
at
to
the
me.
End of his ropes. Yeah. Pouring his heart out as he peed. Yeah. So that was how I started on YouTube, and I didn't
was early on. It was like,
yeah, so
2006,
that was,
right?
Yeah, that was a long time ago. So that was 2008. And I had a couple videos on my channel that were just like demos of me speaking.
Oh, okay.
And I didn't really make any videos. It didn't I really didn't even know what a vlog was. I didn't know that I had made a vlog. And it wasn't until 2010, when my first book came out, Just Don't Fall, that to promote that, I made a video called The Amputee Rap. And yeah. And then that video did really, really well. And that's and people were like, it was kind of like people were like way more excited about that than the book. And I was like, I worked for years on this book and 2 weeks on the video. You should read the book. But I saw then just like, then I started like looking at YouTubers and like seeing guys like you guys and like finding out like, oh, there's this whole world out there of YouTube and like, and I looked like scrolled back and was like, oh my gosh, this like urinal story I told years ago has thousands of views now. Mm-hmm. Like I could keep doing that. And so, yeah, that's like, I kept making vlogs after that.
So how does your YouTube channel fit in? What's into your puzzle at this point?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And one that I spend a lot of time thinking about.
Is it just to drive business to speaking, or does it have a life and a business of its own? There's a tension there, I guess.
Yeah, I think of YouTube mostly as a really intense hobby. I don't have enough subscribers that I could make a living off of it or anything like that. So mostly for me, it's just, I really like making videos and telling stories into a camera, and it's really fun. That said, it is a component. Like if I were to explain my career to people, I would say I give speeches, I give motivational speeches, I write books, and I make YouTube videos. And I think there is a really nice symbiosis to all of those.
Sure.
Most of my income comes from speaking, but a lot of the speaking requests come because people saw a YouTube video or because they read a book. And a lot of the book sales come because people saw me speak or they saw a YouTube video. And so it all kind of works together, I guess, in that sense.
Well, would it be a spoiler alert to ask, you know, what's the ultimate takeaway from the book?
Mm-hmm. No.
Yes, it would.
Well, I mean,
it would. Read the book for the takeaway.
No, I mean, I think, I mean, obviously I'm engaged. So that the big spoiler, of course, is like, well, actually, in the end of the book, I was just dating my girlfriend. So okay. You wouldn't know that from reading that we are engaged now. But yeah, no, I think, you know, with each girl, I learned a little bit something different. So, you know, there was sort of like one, you know, one lesson was about maybe like about like sort of empathy, like what we talked about with the Miss America contestant, or one lesson might be about, you know, not always like assuming sort of like the worst, you know, not assuming like because she said this, oh, she must hate me. Like maybe there's another reasonable explanation. But the overall thing that I think I took away was this, that I went into it, the investigation, assuming that I had never had a girlfriend because there was something wrong with me. And what I realized was actually there had just been a lot of just kind of unlucky situations. And if there was anything wrong with me, it was that assumption. It was thinking that there was something wrong with me. In other words, it was like having that insecurity, that doubt, that like thinking, oh, there's something like inadequate about me, right? Because you know, like that's like the least attractive thing in a person, right? But the most attractive person, by contrast, is someone who's like, who is confident in who they are, like flaws and all. They're like, this is who I am. I accept myself as who I am. And I think like that's what makes you a tremendously attractive person to someone that you might be interested in dating.
Right. And how did your fiance feel about all the stories about all the ladies?
Yeah, I definitely like talked to her a lot about it, you know, before it became a book, just to like make sure she was gonna be cool with it. And I think she was really pleased to be the happy ending of the book. Like, I think like,
and that, really pleased that you were such an idiot all along the way.
Yeah. No, I think, yeah, I think she's like, is kind enough to think that she's very lucky that the other girls didn't discover me or something. but yeah, you know, I think she loves, and rightly so. And I'm glad that she does, you know, being that she's like the person at the end who sort of like, is like, I finally found someone and it's her.
Right.
What stands out as one of the best responses you've gotten? I'm sure there's a lot of people who come up and want to talk to you whenever you speak. And what stands out as one of the stupidest things? Like you talk about the people who just have to say something, and then I'll see if I can top both.
Okay. So as far as like after giving a speech...
Yeah, I mean, like there's got to be. I imagine,
or just like, anything you've done in public.
I imagine the rewarding moment of someone wanting to. You've opened up and inspired.
Yeah,
that someone's they want to give back. Someone said, I imagine there's been a lot of people saying great things to you.
Oh yeah, so I mean, yeah, you know, so many amazing things, and that's certainly like one of the coolest and most rewarding parts of the job. You know, is being able to do something that I really enjoy, like performing and sharing my story. And that I get to do it professionally, and that it's something that helps people. So many things. I guess probably the most poignant example would be a girl came up to me in one of my early speeches. That was when I was not really even a good speaker. Came up to me and like gave me a suicide prevention hotline card, and was like, you know, like thanks to you, like I feel like I don't need this anymore. And that meant a lot to me. And so as far as sort of the flip side, I've really heard it all. I like, you know, it's like people after you give a speech, because they've just heard you, and you guys probably relate to this as YouTubers, like, you know, when you meet someone and they're kind of like, wait, what, why aren't you doing a YouTube video for me right now? Like if you ask them a question, or if there's like a pause, they're like, hold on, why are you not, where are the jump cuts? Like, you know, and so, you know, people kind of come up to you after a speech and are just kind of like, where's my motivational speech? Like, why are you not speaking? Why are you not, why are you not telling long stories with jokes right now? And that's weird. But yeah, people will relate. And it's like, I hate to like belittle people's problems, you know, but they'll be like, I understand what it's like to have one leg because, and then just say, you know, like,
you're like, oh, where are they going to go with this?
But, you know, and sometimes people will, you know, have like a really serious problem, but, you know, like it'll be like I hate to be like trivial, but it'll be like some, you know, just something really like, you know, because oftentimes people are like, because like I sprained my ankle last year and I was on crutches for 2 weeks. So like I totally get like what you've gone through. And I'm like, cool. I'm glad.
I'm sure you're always gracious.
I try to be nice. I'm like, cool. Like, I'm not trying. Yeah. It's like, it's a little different.
Yeah, it looks a little.
But I'm glad that it spoke to you.
I don't know if I want to. I don't know if I want to. So, but try to top that.
Well, I mean, you don't have to top it, but I share your what are some meaningful and really strange things people have said to you.
Oh no! I was gonna try to be one of those people and ask.
You were gonna do try. I thought there was gonna be like story time with.
I
Link.
Didn't know where you were going with that either. You know?
See if I could ask something even stupider. Oh, than yeah. What people have asked.
Oh
you.
Man! Oh, if you want to talk about stupid questions, wow! Like, I mean, just in terms
that's
of
what I mean.
In terms
questions.
Of just pure questions, pff, yes.
How about this one? What do they do with the leg after they get rid of it?
Yeah, I don't think that's a stupid question, and that's something that I would be curious about. I mean, I kind of know they like study it to like because you know just for like sort of case history information to know because it's a rare form of cancer, right? So it's like they want to know like how much did it spread into the muscle, and they learned like it spread a lot into the muscle.
Do they say, hey, do you want one last look, or is that usually when it's on you that's the last look for you personally?
Yeah, no, I didn't have anything like that. I've heard of amputees like keeping their like fingernails or toenails. I didn't like ask for that.
Kind of macabre.
Yeah, it seemed a little weird to me, and I feel like eventually you would inevitably come to some ceremony where you're like, I'm going to like throw these into the ocean because I've moved on, you know. So
well,
they,
if you wanted to take the leg, they wouldn't have let you do it. Probably.
I hope not.
Dentists won't let you take a tooth.
Yeah, you can't.
Yeah, you should hope that they would not allow you to walk out with an actual limb. But yeah, I'll give you some stupid questions that people have asked me. And these are the really stupid questions are typically not after a speech. And I think the reason is because I make fun of in my speeches. A lot of times I talk about stupid questions that people ask. So I think people are a little like, I don't want to be in the next speech. So the stupid questions are inevitably just people who walk up to me on the sidewalk. So or just, you know, casual conversations. So maybe my all time list would be I was talking to this girl about my artificial leg. Which I was wearing. I still wore a leg. This was in high school. And we're talking about how it worked, and you know, everybody has questions about artificial legs. Right. And she was like, "Oh, so is the foot fake too?"
Really?
Yeah. Wow. Really? Like totally serious. I don't know. Like I just don't even know how. Like what the like? And I was like, "Oh, you know, it's funny you ask. Like the doctors actually." Took my real foot and attached it on the end of my artificial leg.
Foot fake too.
Yeah.
Oh my.
Yeah. I don't even know. Like, how could she imagine that that was? Yeah. There's like a Frankenstein system.
She
where,
doesn't understand blood supply.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, there's blood running through the fake leg to nourish the, like, yeah. I mean,
oh, wow.
Yeah. So that happened.
That was amazing.
I had a guy pretty recently. Maybe a year ago now, I live just outside Washington, D.C., and he was in my neighborhood. I was walking on the sidewalk, and I was on my crutches, no prosthesis, and he like taps me on the shoulder, of course, because I have one leg, so he needs to talk to me about it, and just his opening line, he's like, "So, how come you don't have a prostate?"
Oh, how could you tell?
Yeah, exactly. I was like,
where's the other hand?
Do you have X-ray vision? How do you know this information? And then I figured out like what he meant. But I was like, that is not the kind of cancer that I had, actually. It was bone cancer.
Man.
Yeah, and just in terms of sheer stupidity, on my third date with Ashley... so this was like, you know, pretty new relationship. And we're at...
hold on, don't throw your fiance under the bus.
Oh, no, this is not a question she asked.
Okay, good.
Although she has asked some...
I was going to save you from that one.
Oh, no, yeah. No, she's asked some pretty good questions.
pretty good questions.
Pretty good, yeah, we'll
she's
put it that way.
She's a great person.
Yeah. no, she was there to witness it.
Okay,
I'm trying to raise the stakes of story.
Gotcha.
Because it's like we're nervous, we're on an initial date. And
gotcha.
So we were eating dessert, and it was sort of like a dessert bar, you know? And so... So she was sitting beside me on one side, and there's this guy sitting beside me on the other side, like, you know, inevitably wants to talk about how I have one leg and all this situation. Like, this is like a grown man. I just want to be very clear. I don't think he was like intoxicated or anything. And he was like, he was like, so, like, how long is it going to take before, you know? And I was like, no, I don't know, actually. Like, what are you asking?
He thinks you're a starfish.
And yes. And he was like, I kid you not. He's like, how long is it going to take for your leg to grow back? And I was, are you serious right now?
Wow.
Are you like, yeah, exactly. Like, do I look like a starfish? Or do I look like a lizard? Like, I can just spontaneously regrow appendages?
How does someone get to adulthood?
Right,
in the modern world,
what in his life experience had like indicated to him?
Maybe he had one grow back.
How
long did it take you?
Mine only took 5 years.
Yeah, right.
But the hilarious thing was, I mean, because I think he was genuinely sincere, and this is why I believe that, because after that he got a lot more serious. And he was like, oh, man. And he's like, can I buy you a drink?
After you told him.
Yeah.
Know that it's not coming back.
Yeah, because I was like, yes, thank you. This is a great solution. I can turn to alcohol to like help me feel better about how my leg is not going to grow back.
Let me buy you a drink, son.
Yeah, I'll buy you a drink because that leg ain't coming back.
He should have just said, well, just grab and pull right here and it'll probably only take 5 seconds.
Yeah, right. Well, and I know we didn't even get into it, but people can read your first book, Just Don't Fall, when you were a skier too.
That's right. Yeah,
for a long time. There's quite a lot. We could talk to you forever.
Yeah, a lot of,
that's
a lot of life story.
We can throw people to your books. You know, more stories about the encounters with the ladies, and we should hang out sometime. And more stories about your life and your background, and Just Don't Fall. And you tell a lot of stories on your YouTube channel, which people can check out too.
Yeah,
yeah. We truly appreciate being able to hang out and get to know you. And thanks for allowing us to ask all the questions that we ask, which some of those may rank up there.
No, those are awesome questions. And no, it's an honor to be here and so fun to hang out with you guys.
And there you have it, our Ear Biscuit with Josh Sundquist. Let him know what you think by tweeting at him. His Twitter handle is Josh Sund. Quist. There's a D in there.
Yeah, I always make sure to say the D.
Quist. Sundquist.
It's not Sundquist like Sunkissed. It's Sundquist.
Hashtag Earbiscuits. And also make sure that you watch our Song Biscuit with Josh.
And check out his book, We Should Hang Out Sometime.com. That's the way it's done these days. You write a book and then you name a website that's the same thing as the book.
Yeah, where you can get it. We Should Hang Out Sometime.com. Maybe we should write a book. Maybe we should do the same thing. It's such a good idea. We could get his permission first. We go track down our ex-girlfriends.
Well, and the interesting thing is a few of them are the same girl.
Yeah,
so a couple of the chapters, there would be the crossover chapters is what we would call those.
Right.
Leslie and Amber.
But the thing is, I think we know what went wrong with Leslie that led to each of our breakups.
Yeah, we didn't talk to her, you know. I don't need to write a book about that.
Yeah, I didn't know how to speak to a girl.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And
I was afraid of her.
With Amber, I don't remember.
I think with you, it probably ended the same way. You didn't know how to manage a relationship. I think I had a real relationship. There could be a chapter there.
With Amber?
Yeah, I'll write the Amber chapter. You can offer commentary and like this. We'll do a thing where when one guy's writing, the other guy writes in the margins. But it's part of the book.
Who are we kidding? We've talked about our ex-girlfriends so much that we can't write a book. I mean, you've heard it all, people. I mean, so instead of you buying a book from us about our ex-girlfriends, we're just going to remind you to take the podsurvey.com/biscuits survey. Again, that takes 5 minutes. Thanks for listening this long. You're a true listener. You're still listening to us. And like we said, it will really help us out to find out what you're truly interested in. Let's line up some advertisers that make sense for both of us so that you don't have to pay for this podcast.
Yeah, because if you, if it doesn't work, we're going to start charging. What are we thinking about charging? $1,000 per download? Is that what it is?
Yeah, that's the price point.
So per person, so you know.
Either that or go to Pod
That's
Survey.
Very expensive. I know you like this, but that would be very expensive.
/business.
That would be like a salary a year per person just to listen to this podcast, and you don't want that to happen.
All right, so the Ear Biscuit is winding down. You can hear the music back there, so just go ahead and pull up that, you know, Apple T browser window.
Oh, what if they're on a Windows machine?
Whatever that is, Apple W.
I think there's an actual window. Instead of an Apple, it's like a window that's flying through the air.
Podsurvey.com/biscuits. Podsurvey.com/biscuits.
More than one biscuit.
With an S.
Yeah.
Podsurvey.com/biscuits.